On the fourth day, when Ramon came to her room in the clinic, he was accompanied by three sober gentlemen in dark suits, all of them bearing important-looking briefcases. One was an attorney, another was an official from the state registrar's office, and the third was the local magistrate. The magistrate bore witness as Isabella signed the order of adoption, relinquishing her guardianship of Nicholas to the Marquess de Santiago y Machado. And he placed his official seal on the document. The birth certificate provided by the registrar showed Ramon as the father. After the officials had toasted the mother and child with a large glass of sherry and left, Ramon took Isabella tenderly in his arms. "Your son's claim to the title is secure," he whispered. "Our son," she whispered in reply, and kissed him. "My men, Nicky and Ramon." When Ramon fetched them from the clinic and brought them back to the flat, Isabella insisted on carrying Nicky up the stairs herself. Adra had filled bowls of flowers to welcome them. She took the child out of Isabella's arms. "He is wet. I will change him." And Isabella felt like a lioness deprived of her cub. Over the days that followed, an unspoken but nevertheless intense competition developed between the two women. Although Isabella acknowledged Adra's obvious expertise in dealing with the infant, she found herself resenting the intrusion. She wanted Nicky all to herself, and she tried to anticipate his needs and to get to him ahead of Adra. The florid birth tones of Nicky's face soon faded into a peachy perfection, and his thick dark hair curled. When he opened his eyes for the first time, they were that exact same shade of pale green as Ramon's. Isabella considered this one of the great miracles of the universe. "You are as beautiful as your father," she told him, as she suckled him. At least that was one service that Adra could not render him. In the months that they had lived in the village, Isabella had become a local favourite. Her loveliness and her easy, engaging manner, her pregnancy and her sincere efforts to master the language, had delighted the tradespeople and the stallholders in the marketplace. In response to their entreaties, when Nicky was barely 10 days old, she laid him in the pram and paraded him through the village. It was a triumphant progress, and they returned to the flat, laden with small gifts and with their ears ringing with praises. When she phoned home on Easter Day, her grandmother asked severely, "What is so important in Spain that you cannot come home to Weltefrieden?"
"Oh, Nana, I love you all, but it's just impossible. Please forgive me.
If I know you, young lady, which I do, you are up to no good, and it wears trousers."
"Nana, you're an absolute shocker. How can you believe that of me?"
20 years of experience," Santon Courtney Malcolm S. told her dryly. "Just don't get into any more trouble, child."
"I won't, I promise," Isabella told her sweetly, and hugged the infant to her bosom.
"Oh, if only you knew," she thought. "He doesn't wear trousers. Well, not yet, anyway."
"How's the thesis going?" her father asked when he came on the line. She could not tell him that she had already submitted it, for that was her excuse for remaining in Spain.
"Almost done," she compromised.
She hadn't thought about it since Nicky had come along.
"Good luck with it."
And then Shaza was silent for a moment.
"Do you remember our talk? The promise you gave me?"
Which one?"
she procrastinated guiltily. She knew very well what he was referring to.
"You promised that if you were ever in trouble, any trouble at all, you wouldn't try to go it alone. You would come to me."
"Yes, I remember."
"Are you all right, Bella baby?"
"I'm fine. Wonderful, just marvellous, Daddy."
He heard the ring of it in her voice and sighed with relief.
"Happy Easter, my bright and beautiful daughter."
With Michael, it was a relief to let it all out of her. They were on the telephone for 45 minutes, Malaga to Johannesburg, and she tickled Nicky to make him gurgle for his distant uncle.
"When are you coming home, Bella?" Michael asked at last.
"Ramon's divorce will be through by June, that's definite. We will have a civil marriage here in Spain and the church wedding at Weltefrieden. I expect you to be at both functions."
"Try to stop me," he challenged her.
They celebrated Easter dinner at their favourite seaside restaurant, with Nicky's pram parked at the table. The patron's wife had knitted a jacket for the baby. Adra was with them. She was part of their small family by now, and she wheeled the pram when they walked home to the flat. Isabella clung to Ramon's arm. She felt very married and maternal, and as happy as she had ever been in her entire life. When they arrived at the flat, Adra took Nicky away to change him. For once, Isabella did not resent it. In the front bedroom, she lowered the shutters and then came to Ramon.
"It's 3 weeks since Nicky was born. I'm not made of glass, you know. I won't break."
He was too gentle, too considerate for her mood. She had been without him for too long.
"I think you've forgotten how to do this," she said, and pushed him over on his back. "Let me refresh your memory, sir."
"Don't hurt yourself," he cautioned anxiously.
"If anybody gets hurt around here, it's more likely to be you, my friend. Now fasten your seatbelt. We're ready for takeoff."
Afterwards, in the shuttered room, she lay against him in languorous exhaustion, their bodies sticking lightly together with the sweat of their loving, and he said, "I have to go away for 4 days next week." She sat up quickly.
"Oh, Ramon, so soon," she protested,
and then realized that she was being possessive and unreasonable.
"You'll phone me every day, won't you?" she demanded.
"I'll do better than that.
I'll be in Paris, and I'll try to arrange for you to join me there. We will have dinner at La Serre." "Oh, that would be lovely, but what about Nicky?"
"Oh, Nicky's got Adra to look after him," Ramon chuckled. "Nicky will be all right, and Adra will love the opportunity to have him all to herself."
"Oh, I don't know," she said dubiously.
The thought of being parted from her wondrous achievement for even an hour appalled her.
"It'll be for only one night, and you have really earned a little reward. Come on. Besides, I need you too, you know."
"Oh, my darling." His appeal touched her. Her flow of milk was copious. She could express enough to cover the feeds that Nicky would need during such a short absence.
"Of course, I'd love to be with you. You're right. Nicky and Adra will survive a night without me. I'll come as soon as you call me."
"The woman gave birth to her brat almost a month ago," General Joseph Cicero whispered hoarsely. "What has been the delay? You should have terminated the operation immediately. The cost has been out of all proportion."
"The general will recall that I am meeting the cost out of funds that I have provided, not out of the departmental budget," Ramon reminded him quietly. Cicero coughed and rustled the copy of Francois, which he held before his face. They sat side by side in a second-class coach of the Paris Metro. Cicero had entered the coach at the Concorde station and taken the seat beside Ramon. Neither of them had shown any sign of recognition. The rush of the train through the underground tunnel would foil any eavesdropper. Both of them used open newspapers to cover their faces as they talked. This was one of their regular procedures for short meetings.
"I was not referring only to the cost in rubles," Cicero wheezed. "You have spent nearly a year on this project, an incalculable cost to the other work of the department."
Ramon was fascinated by the rapid course of the disease that was destroying his superior. It seemed that at every meeting, Joseph Cicero had deteriorated visibly. It would not be much longer. Months rather than years. "These few months of work will pay us back enormous dividends over the years, and, yes, over the decades ahead."
"Work," snorted Cicero, "stirring the honey pot with your spoon. If that is work, how do you define pleasure, Marquez? And why are you prolonging termination month after month?"
"If the woman is to be the utmost value to us, then it is absolutely necessary that she bond to the child before we proceed to the next step in the operation."
"When will that be?" Cicero demanded.
"It has happened already. The fruit is ripe for picking. Everything is in place. I need your cooperation in the final resolution. And that is why I chose Paris for this meeting." Cicero nodded.
"Well, go on," he invited.
And Ramon spoke quietly for another 5 minutes. Cicero listened without comment, but grudgingly he admitted to himself that the plan was airtight. Once again he acceded privately that his successor seemed to have been well chosen, despite the original prejudice he had fostered towards him.
"Oh, very well," he whispered at last. "You have approval to proceed. And as you request, I will monitor proceedings at this end."
Cicero folded his newspaper and stood up as the coach slid into the metro station at Bastille on its silent rubber wheels. As the doors opened, he stepped down onto the platform and walked away without looking back. The notification from London University arrived the afternoon that Ramon left. It took the form of an express letter with the university's coat of arms embossed on the flap of the envelope. The Chancellor and the faculty members of the University of London take pleasure in informing Isabella Courtney that she has been awarded the degree of Doctor of Philosophy of the University. Isabella telephoned Felta Friedan immediately. There was little time difference between Malaga and Cape Town, and Shaza had just returned from the polo field. He was still in boots and breeches, and he took the call in the downstairs study, whose French windows overlooked the field. "Son of a gun!" he let out a whoop when she told him. Such an uncharacteristic display was proof to her of her father's deep delight. "When will they cap you, darling?"
"Oh, not until June or July. I'll have to stay until then."
It was the excuse she had been looking for.
"Of course," Shaza agreed immediately.
"I'll come over."
"Oh, Daddy, it's such a long way."
"Nonsense, Dr. Courtney. I wouldn't miss it for the world. Your grandmother will probably want to come with me." Strangely, the prospect did not alarm her, as it might have. She realized that it was probably the ideal occasion for both her father and Nana to meet Ramon and Nicky. Santon Courtney Malcolmes, off her home ground, was not such a daunting prospect as she was when installed in all the splendor and tradition of Felta Friedan. More than anything at that moment, Isabella wanted to share her joy in her achievement with Ramon, but he did not telephone that night, nor even the following day. By Thursday morning, she was almost frantic with worry. It was so unlike Ramon. Usually he telephoned every day that they were apart. When finally the telephone rang, she was in the tiny kitchen, in a heated argument with Adra as to how many cloves of garlic should go into the paella.
"You would inject the stuff into your veins if you were given the chance," she accused in her now fluent Spanish. "We are making paella, not Irish stew."
Adra held her ground. And then the telephone rang, and Isabella dropped the spoon with a clatter and knocked over the chair in the hall in her haste to reach it.
"Ramon, darling, I was so worried. I missed your call."
"I'm sorry, Bella." The rich, dark tones of his voice soothed her, so her own voice became a purr.
"Do you still love me?"
"Come to Paris, and I will prove it to you."
"When?"
"Now. I've made a reservation for you on the Air France flight at 11 o'clock. They are holding your ticket at the airport. You will be here by 2 o'clock.
"Where will I meet you?"
"At the Plaza Athene. We have a suite."
"You spoil me, Ramon, darling."
"No less than you deserve."
She left the flat immediately. However, the Air France takeoff was delayed by 40 minutes. In Paris, the baggage handlers were working to rule, so she stood fuming and fretting at the baggage carousel for almost an hour before her overnight case made its leisurely appearance. It was after 5 o'clock in the evening before her taxi pulled up in the Avenue Montaigne, before the elegant façade of the Plaza Athene, with its scarlet awnings. She half expected Ramon to be waiting for her in the marbled and mirrored foyer, and looked about eagerly as she came in through the revolving glass doors. He was not there. She paid no heed to the gaunt figure who sat in one of the gilt and brocade armchairs opposite the reception desk. The man lifted his head of lank white hair and for a moment regarded her with strangely lifeless tar-black eyes. Then he coughed harshly and returned his attention to the newspaper he was reading. Isabella crossed quickly and expectantly to the concierge's counter.
"You have a guest. The Marquise de Santiago y Machado. I am his wife."
"A moment, madame." The uniformed concierge consulted the guest list, and then shook his head and frowned as he started again at the head of the list.
"I am sorry, Marquesa. The Marquise is not staying with us at the moment."
"Well, perhaps he was registered as Monsieur Machado."
"I am afraid not. We have nobody of that name."
Isabella looked confused.
I don't understand. I spoke to him this morning." "I will make a further inquiry."
The concierge left her for a moment to consult the booking clerk and returned almost immediately.
"Your husband is not with us. There is no reservation for him."
"Oh, he must have been delayed.
Isabella tried to look unconcerned. Do you have a room for me?
The hotel is fully booked.
The concierge spread his hands apologetically.
It is spring, you understand. I am desolated, Marchesa. Paris is overflowing.
He must be coming, Isabella insisted brightly. Do you mind if I wait for my husband in the gallery?
Of course not, Marchesa. The waiter will bring you coffee and whatever refreshment you wish. The porter will guard your baggage in his store.